This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's first guest, Michael Chabon, won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel Cavalier in Clay, in which he imagined the lives of people working on the early superhero comic books. He rewrites a different era of history in his new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. It's based on the following premise. What if the fledgling state of Israel collapsed in 1948? And, in the wake of the Holocaust, part of Alaska were set aside as a temporary refuge for Jews. The novel is set 60 years after that imagined event, in Sitka, Alaska, when Jewish rights to the district are running out and it's about to revert to Alaskan control. Every Jew in Sitka is nervously awaiting what will happen next. Here's a short reading from the beginning of the book.
Observant Jews around the world have not abandoned their hope to dwell one day in the land of Zion. But Jews have been tossed out of the joint three times now, in 586 BCE, in 70 CE, and with savage finality in 1948. It's hard even for the faithful not to feel a sense of discouragement about their chances of once again getting a foot in the door.
Michael Chabon, reading from his novel The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is now out in paperback. The main character of the book, Meyer Landsman, is a homicide detective living in this temporary Jewish homeland, investigating a murder. The New York Times called his character one of the most appealing detective heroes to come along since Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe. Terry spoke with Michael Chabon last year.
Michael, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. It's so nice to be here.
How does Sitka become an unlikely homeland for Jews after the Holocaust in your novel?
Well, in my novel, an actual proposal that was made initially by the Department of the Interior under Franklin Roosevelt to permit refugees from Europe, Jewish refugees from Europe primarily, of course, to enter the United States on a very limited, very controlled basis and to settle temporarily, in all likelihood, in Alaska. Has come to pass. So in obviously in our world that didn't happen, and in fact there was a bill introduced into Congress. It was called the King-Havener Bill. It died in committee. It was never brought to the floor for a vote. But in the world of my novel, it actually passed, and these Jews, ultimately several million of them, were allowed to enter the United States. They thought it was going to be a temporary thing, but they ended up the way these things tend to happen, nobody ever quite got around to figuring out what to do with them after the war was over, and they were granted a kind of semi-permanent lease. But that lease in this year, 2007, has now come due, and they all have to figure out where to go now.
And their claim on this territory is running out, so they're going to have to, like, relocate.
Exactly. It's called reversion. The territory, this little ribbon of territory that they were permitted to settle in, and they've all made homes, they've made lives, industries, businesses, and everything. They actually have a whole, almost like a little micro nation that they've created. It's Yiddish speaking, but yes, now this territory is set to revert to the state of Alaska, and Alaska is going to regain control over it, and it will be incorporated into the state.
Well, tell us more about what almost happened historically, the bill that didn't pass but that was talked about.
Well, the Interior Department under Harold Ickes proposed essentially killing two birds with one stone by exploiting the vast untold resources, the wealth of Alaska, which at this time in 1940 was very much untapped and unexploited. And this pressing, heart-wrenching problem of all of these people that were desperate to get out of Nazi-occupied Europe. That sort of humanitarian concern was hidden within this notion that we can exploit Alaska and get a foothold there and so on. And so they proposed letting these refugees settle there, and a bill was introduced. There was very stout opposition. The native Alaskan community, the European, the American descended people living there were vehemently opposed to it. And They were sort of championed by this their delegate to Congress, this guy Anthony Diamond, who was also dead set against this happening, and he campaigned and ultimately was able to quash this thing before it ever even made it into a floor vote in Congress. But I've always been struck by these possible alternate Jewish homelands that have been proposed over the years. It's been proposed, you know, that Jews at one time there was a Uganda plan that the British Empire had put forward that Jews should be allowed to settle in Uganda, Australia, Madagascar. You know, one hears, I think even Suriname, there was a brief Dutch plan to allow the Jews to come into Suriname at some point. So, those what ifs, those might have been, those maybes, those are endlessly fascinating to me. And so I think I just picked it up along the way and never forgot it.
So you've created for your novel this place in Alaska that's a kind of like temporary homeland for Jews displaced by World War II. Can you describe a little bit what this community has grown up like in your novel?
Well, it's a big city. Sitka has become a big city, tall buildings. It's got everything a contemporary city, you know, is expected to have, and the range, from big box shopping malls to symphony orchestra and everything in between. There's a very diverse community of Jews living there, and by diverse I mean they range from the most secular, contemporary, somewhat, deracinated, but just people who don't identify terribly strongly with the religious aspects of Judaism, all the way to ultra-Orthodox Hasidic sects and everything in between. And it's kind of a swinging place in some ways. There's a lot of art and music and culture, and the Yiddish language remains in full flower. On the other hand, it's a dark place. It's in Alaska. It's gray. It's rainy. And there's also this constant anxiety that's been hanging over these people for 60 years that it is meant to be temporary, and it could all be ending soon. In a way, that's been the facts for Jews for the past 2,000 years, in a sense, the knowledge that you, no matter how well you do in a place, no matter how greatly you prosper, your lease could be canceled at any time, at any moment, and you'll have to move on. And so, in one sense, they're living with that consciousness in a way that their ancestors have been living for 1,000 years or more.
Why did you want to combine the fictional story you tell in the book of this alternate version of history, where a homeland for the Jews after World War II is created in Alaska, to combine that with, a detective story?
There was a review in the New Yorker magazine, by Clive James, where he kind of did a roundup of some detective fiction from around the world. He talks about how these detectives are all connected to the cities that they live in, whether it's Venice or Stockholm or wherever it might be. And he said in passing something like, the detective novel has always been in part a guidebook. And I thought that was putting it really well, and it wasn't anything I had ever exactly thought to myself in those terms, but I think I had that sense, so that when I came up with the idea of setting a novel in this imaginary land, I realized I had this job to do of making it feel clear and plausible and articulated to the reader, so that the reader would understand the place. And in order to understand the place, the reader needed a kind of guide. And I felt, I guess just intuitively, that a policeman with his badge and therefore with his access to every level of society, no door is really closed to him, that he would be the perfect guide, that in the company of a policeman, we would be able to go everywhere and see everything.
In your novel, there's an island called Verbov that is populated by ultra-Orthodox Jews who are known as Verbovers. And there's a passage I'd like you to read that's set on the island that describes the ultra-Orthodox Jews that live there. Could you just set up who we'll be hearing from in this short reading?
Yes. Meyer Lantzman, the protagonist of the novel, is a homicide detective in Sitka. And he and his partner, Berko Shemitz, have drawn this case. There's a murder in the opening pages of the novel, and in pursuit of a lead they've gotten that the victim might have possibly been connected to the Verboverse in some way. They've decided to brave Verbov Island, which is this kind of almost like a, I think it's an idealized shtetl in many ways. It was created sort of out of nothing by this sect, this ultra-Orthodox sect, to recreate the world of their sect's homeland in Verbov back in the old country, which Verbov is a, I think it's a small city somewhere in Eastern Europe and Russia or Poland. My mother's maiden name was Verbo, or her mother's maiden name, so I was just kind of trying to draw on my own heritage and naming it. There is no such sect, obviously. Friday afternoon on Verbov Island, and Lantzmann's Chevelle Supersport surfs the wave of black hats along Avenue 225. "Look at this place," Lantzmann says. "It's hopping." "Not one empty storefront," Berko says. "And more of these no-good yids than ever." Lantzmann stops for a red at Northwest 28th Street. Outside a corner store by a study hall, Torah bachelors loiter, scripture grifters, unmatchable Luftmensches, and garden variety hoodlums. When they notice Lantzmann's car with its reek of plainclothesman hubris and its inflammatory double S on the grill, they leave off yelling at one another and give Lantzmann the Bessarabian fisheye. He is on their turf. He goes clean-shaven and does not tremble before God. He is not a Verbover Jew, and therefore is not really a Jew at all. And if he is not a Jew, then he is nothing. "Look at those bums looking," Lantzmann says. "I don't like it." "Meyer." The truth is, black hat Jews make Lantzmann angry, and they always have. He finds that it is a pleasurable anger, rich with layers of envy, condescension, resentment, and pity.
That's Michael Chabon reading from his new book, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. What you're getting at in that reading is the division between secular Jews, like your main character, who's a homicide detective, and the ultra-Orthodox Jews, who are in this this new homeland for the Jews in Alaska. But, you know, that division exists in real life.
Absolutely.
And why did you want to write about that division?
Well, it seemed to me to be an inevitable feature of any large community of Jews living all together. You know, I felt like it would be inaccurate portrayal of this place if those fissures didn't exist. And really, that my knowledge of that comes out of my knowledge of Israel, the state of Israel, in our world, my somewhat limited knowledge, but it was apparent to me on my one visit to Israel that there's so many divisions among Jews there, not just between ultra-Orthodox and secular, but between Ashkenazic and Sephardic and Russians and non-Russians and so on, that it would have been inaccurate to leave that out.
Now, what do you like about taking history and completely rewriting it with a different premise? You did that with comic books and Cavalier and Clay, and you're doing it with a Jewish homeland in your new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union.
Well, actually, I think it has a lot to do with comic books in a way. When I was a young kid reading comic books, there was a sort of very popular kind of story that was being written then. It was popular starting in the 50s, and in particular in Superman comic books. That was called the imaginary story, which I kind of love that distinction being made. But imaginary Superman stories were Superman stories in which something was different than in the sort of official canonic Superman story, where he comes to Earth and crashes in outside of Smallville, you know, and the Kents rescue him from his rocket ship and they raise him. And they would do these stories, you know, what if Superman's rocket ship had landed in Africa? Or what if the rocket ship from Krypton had landed in Canada, you know, and we had a Canadian Superman? What would that be like? Or what if Lois Lane was the one who came from Krypton? And that sort of hypothetical story, the what if story, which then later also was done a lot at Marvel. And in fact, Marvel Comics had a whole series called What If, in which, you know, the Fantastic Four each had the other one's powers and so on. I think that was really my first introduction to the idea of counterfactual or hypothetical kinds of stories, the what-if story. What if this one thing had been different? And it's always a kind of story I took an interest in. There's a classic novel called Lest Darkness Fall by Elsbreg de Camp, in which the Roman Empire never fell and has survived into the modern era and so on. I was always drawn to those kinds of stories. I mean, I think anyone who lies awake at night sort of going back over the course of his or her life and asking him or herself the question, you know, how did I get here? That sort of David Byrne question, you know. I mean, at every moment, you're making choices that determine the future course of your life, but there always do seem to be these sort of key junctures where if I had taken that job or if I had said yes to that person, if I had done this, if I had done that, my whole life would have been different. I think we have that tendency to do that with our individual histories, and then it's just a short step away to do it with history, with a capital H, and look at those sort of what seem to be juncture moments and wonder how things might have come out differently.
So if those what-if moments in comic books inspired your new novel, what was the first, like, what-if you came up with for your novel?
Well, the genesis of the novel really lay in this book, an actual book published by Dover Publications called Say It in Yiddish. And Say It in Yiddish is subtitled A Phrasebook for Travelers. And I came upon this book in a bookstore. I was entranced immediately by the idea of there being a phrasebook for travelers in Yiddish that's, like any phrasebook, is full of all these unintentionally droll things that you might need to say, such as, I need a tourniquet. Or, you know, which way to the casino. And I was so struck by this idea of a phrasebook in Yiddish with no obvious destination that I wrote an essay that was published many years ago now where I sort of speculated on possible places that might have come into being where you could have taken this phrasebook for Yiddish as you would take, say, it in French to France or say it in Swahili to Africa.
Because there is no country in which Yiddish is the national tongue.
No, I mean, and there, you know, in a sense, there was at one time. I mean, there were many millions of Yiddish speakers in Europe going up to, right, and, you know, obviously in America as well, going right up to the Second World War. But they never had, Yiddish speakers never had a country of their own, the kind of place that seemed to be implied by this phrasebook that gave you phrases to use when dealing with customs officials in Yiddish and, you know, casino employees, airline employees, and so on. Like the idea of a Yiddish airline, for example, a Yiddish-speaking Jewish airline just entranced me. And so, I mean, the initial what if was not a specific forking in history so much as a what if there really were a country where everyone spoke Yiddish? What would that be like? And so that what if was presented to me by this little book, Say It in Yiddish, that I came upon so many years ago now.
When you're creating like a whole fictional world, you know, that rewrites history, you have to make sure that you're consistent and that everything you create kind of adds up. So right. What kind of like map of the world did you have to create so that you knew, you know, did you actually have like a plan on the wall someplace with like a flow chart or a timetable so mm-hmm. that you could follow your own rules in this world that you created?
You bet. I mean, you know, I got into this business so that I could do that kind of thing. I mean, when I was a kid, it all, for me, writing, creative writing, as you know, we called it in school back then, it all had to do with maps and charts and diagrams and chronicles. And, you know, I was really into Lord of the Rings and the whole kind of apparatus that Tolkien created around. I mean, in a way, the story in the case of Tolkien was just an excuse to invent the languages from his point of view and draw the maps and make the charts and the chronologies. And I had the sense from a very early age that maps and making maps and charts and chronicles was part of the writer's job. And I grew up in this town in Maryland, Columbia, Maryland, that was a planned community that was built in the suburbs between Baltimore and Washington, in the countryside between Baltimore and Washington back in the late 60s. And we moved there when Columbia itself, which is now a city of close to 100,000 people, existed almost entirely on paper as maps, as plans, as diagrams and charts and proposals and projections. And I sort of grew up in this place where the maps were translated into reality before my very eyes, where the houses would be built. You know, there would be a street proposed. They would come out with stakes and strings and stake it out. And then over the course of the next several months, the street would be laid, the pavement, the sidewalks, the houses would grow, and it would all sprout before my very eyes. It was this very powerful demonstration of the of how somebody's idea, somebody's map that they just make up, and they come up with all these names for streets and neighborhoods and so on. And so starting this novel, I did draw maps for my own use, city maps and territorial maps, and I came up with a timeline of world history in the event that the state of Israel didn't come into existence because it failed to come into existence in this world. And I don't know. I just felt like it was all there for my benefit to make the book, hopefully the world within the book, seem real and feel real and be clear to the reader.
Michael Chabon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Author Michael Chabon, speaking with Terry Gross in 2007. His new novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, is now out in paperback. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. Nearly three decades ago, Steven Spielberg collaborated with producer George Lucas and actor Harrison Ford on Raiders of the Lost Ark, a film that paid homage to the cliffhanger action serials of the 1930s. Then came Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and 19 years ago, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Now the three men have teamed up once again for Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
A shot early in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull reminds you why no mainstream filmmaker since Orson Welles can touch Steven Spielberg when it comes to camera movement and composition. Or more precisely, to composition that gets more vivid as the camera moves. Harrison Ford's Indiana Jones is held at gunpoint by murderous Soviet soldiers, led by an icy Cate Blanchett as a scientist called Irina Spalko. They're in a giant warehouse, and Spalko orders Indy to hunt down a crate with precious contents. Indy climbs some crates. He's in the foreground. The camera holds on him, tracking back and up, and the space opens up behind him. We see Spalko and the soldiers gazing up, and the warehouse, with its built-in obstacle course of boxes, spreading out in the background. That's it. Nothing flashy, nothing to make film students cry, great shot. But it tells you, simply and elegantly, everything you need to know about the setting, the threat, the variables in play. It's the work of a man with film storytelling in his blood. What a bummer when the story is such a big, noisy nothing. The setup is certainly smart. It's the 50s, and Professor Jones is getting old. The nuclear age and the Cold War have come, and McCarthyism has hit academia. He has no family. His father is dead. There's no wife or child, or so he thinks. Into this comes motorcycle-riding greaser Mutt, played by Shia LaBeouf. He says he's been sent by his mother, one Mary, held captive in the Amazon, along with Indy's old friend, Professor Oxley. Mutt is a dropout, which would bother Indy if he were the kid's father. Hold on, he is the kid's father. Mary turns out to be Marion, Karen Allen, from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mutt is Henry Jones III. Oh, but what lackluster tasks await the aging adventurer and his spawn as they embark on a quest that makes the Da Vinci Code look like a model of plot construction. Indy and Mutt open tombs, dodge poison darts, get captured, break out, get captured again, break out, get chased, and get captured again. The action is the movie's reason for being, of course, but the setups are wittier than the payoffs. Indy finds himself on a nuclear test site, amid life-size dummies of mom, dad, and kids, the nuclear family, ha-ha, and the way he escapes the H-blast is a howl. But the sequence has no punchline. A jeep chase through the jungle features Indy and son leaping between vehicles as the eponymous skull flies back and forth. So many variables, so many stunts, so little snap. Harrison Ford never brought much to the show, but he knew how to lighten his clenched persona with goofy shrugs that said, I can only go so far with this hero stuff. But the breeziness is gone. He now seems like a peevish movie star who's too self-centered to interact. When he's supposed to realize that Marion is the lost love of his life, it looks as if he's gritting his teeth to kiss her. Blanchette is a great photographic object, her satin skin taut over those high cheekbones, her black hair cut sharply across her forehead. But how many variations of, "We meet again, Professor Jones," can you do? Spielberg has evolved as an artist since the last Indiana Jones picture. He's grown beyond this, and even with his pet theme, absent fathers and sons, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull has no urgency. It's not just the shallow script. All the computer-generated imagery in the action scenes muffles something vital in his technique. It removes the intangible element of gravity and blands out his staging. The state-of-the-art effects have a way of making the actors' advanced ages more, not less, pronounced. As they run from CGI explosions, you can almost hear their joints creak. Or is that Spielberg wheezing?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Neil Diamond has just accomplished something he'd never done in his nearly half-century-long music career. He's landed an album at the top of the Billboard charts. His new number one CD, Home Before Dark, got a huge boost from his recent appearances on American Idol, making him the oldest chart topper in U.S. album history, nudging aside Bob Dylan. It didn't hurt that Neil Diamond's producer is Rick Rubin, who did all those fabulous final recordings with Johnny Cash. Here's a sample from Diamond's Home Before Dark, a song called Don't Go There.
She wants to take it just a little bit further now. Don't let it happen, 'cause if you let her in, she's gonna take it away, making you pay. And what are you gonna say? You better beware and don't go there. Don't wanna let her play with what belongs to you. If you let her play with you, know what, you know what she's gonna do. She's gonna take it from you. That's just what she's gonna do. I don't know where, and don't go there. A voice is sitting on my shoulder.
Neil Diamond started writing songs in the early 1960s and wrote a number one hit for the Monkees, I'm a Believer. But it was Diamond himself who made most of his own songs famous. Songs like Solitary Man, Cherry Cherry, Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, Kentucky Woman, and Sweet Caroline. As many of his contemporaries fell off the charts, Diamond moved from teen pop to adult pop. He recorded a duet with Barbara Streisand, had hits from his remake of The Jazz Singer, and dressed in spangles for his sold-out Vegas concerts. In 2005, he reversed course and went intentionally non-glitzy, working with Rick Rubin for the first time on an album called 12 Songs. That's when Terry Gross spoke with Neil Diamond and asked him about his early songwriting days.
I think it's fair to say your first big break, correct me if I'm wrong, was when you had recorded a demo. And the songwriters, Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, heard the demo and they really liked you. And they, some of their songs are Do Do Run Run, Chapel of Love.
Be My Baby.
Be My Baby, yeah. So how did they hear you?
I was making a demo. Usually when you sold a song to a publisher, they would allow you to go in and make your own demo, which was an invaluable experience to me. But I went and made the demo and hired Ellie as a backup singer, which she did, despite the fact that she was having huge hits. She liked to sing in the studios with the other girls. And so I hired her for this session, and she liked something about what I was doing, my writing or my singing. And she brought me to her husband, Jeff, and he liked something about my what I was doing. I don't know if he liked the writing or the singing, but one liked one and the other one liked the other. So we started a working relationship. We were both working for the same music publisher, and I kind of got let go by that music publisher, and I asked Jeff and Ellie if they were interested in producing me.
In the first session that you did with them, you recorded Solitary Man. Did you like the idea of horns on this?
I like the idea of anything on those records. I was just thrilled to be there.
Well, let's hear Solitary Man, which I have to say, I think it's really a terrific recording.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, okay, let's hear it. This is your first hit, yes?
Yes,
you recorded yourself.
Hit.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Neil Diamond, Solitary Man.
The Linda was mine till the time that I found her. Holding Jim, loving him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong, that's what I thought. Me and Sue, that died too. Don't know that I will, but until I can find me a girl to stay and won't play games behind me, and I'll be what I am. A solid.
Neil Diamond. Now, did you write this song for yourself or for somebody else?
No, I wrote this for myself. I had a contract with Jeff and Ellie, and I started to focus in on just what I wanted to do. And so Solitary Man was written for me and for the first sessions that I was to do with Jeff and Ellie.
When you were working as a songwriter for publishers, writing for other people, were you writing for specific people? Were you writing with specific singers in mind?
Well, that's usually how it went back then, although I was never a good enough writer to kind of write for some other singer to understand what they did best, the keys, the kind of song. Usually you were told that so-and-so is coming up for a session in 3 weeks and they need a song of this type. And it was usually as close as possible to the song that they had previously, which was a hit, if it was a hit. And you had to write a kind of like a copy of that in a way, because that's the way it worked in those days. You have a hit record, and your next record should sound as much like the hit record as you can make it. But I wasn't very good at it. It's probably why I spent 8 years down there in Timpan Alley and had very little success.
Now, the Monkees did a couple of your songs, I'm a Believer and A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. Did you write those with them in mind or for yourself? I'm trying to think of what the chronology was. Like, you start recording in, what, like 67?
66.
66, okay. And what year are the Monkees? Like, is that after that?
I think 67, something like that. I had recorded a couple of songs, including Solitary Man and Jerry Jerry, which was a big hit. And because of that hit, the people who were producing the Monkees called and said, we like Cherry Cherry. Do you have any other songs? I said, well, I don't have anything like Cherry Cherry, but I have an album coming out soon, and I'll send it over and take your pick.
My guest is Neil Diamond. Here's his version of I'm a Believer.
Someone else, but not for me. Love was out to get me. That's the way it seemed. Disappointing, haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote and recorded, a big hit for you, Sweet Caroline. which is now played at Red Sox games at Fenway Park, and maybe you know the story of why of why that is. But let's start with the song itself. Is there a story behind the writing of the song?
Yeah, I think so. I was heading down to Memphis for my first recording session down there. There were some producers I wanted to work with, and I only had two songs written. And in those days, a session was 3 hours, and you usually had three songs that you recorded. So the night before the session at some motel in Memphis, I knocked out this song, Sweet Caroline. It was one of the fastest songs I've ever written. And we recorded it the next day, and it became one of my biggest songs, if not the biggest song. But songs usually don't come like that. There's usually a lot of work and teeth gnashing and agony and torment over any of these songs. But that one just popped out, and there it was, and here it is now. Still, people can sing it.
It's also sung a lot in bars.
Well, the fact is that it's fun and easy to sing with. And I think that that's the bottom line as far as that song is concerned. It's easy to sing. It's fun. People like to sing it. And that's why it's popular in bars, because anybody can sing it, no matter how many drinks you've had.
Where it began, I can't begin to knowing, but then I know it's growing strong. Wasn't the spring, and spring became the summer. Who'd have believed you'd come along? Touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you.
One of the things you've done is, you know, you started in the movie, the jazz singer, and it was a kind of updated, new interpretation of the Al Jolson movie.
Right.
And in this movie, you're a rock singer, but your father's a cantor, and he wants you to lead the more traditional life and to sing the more traditional material, and you're of course doing neither, and he acts as if he's in mourning, and he's completely lost his son. And of course, you wrote all the songs for it too. Now, in your father wasn't a cantor, but he did,
no,
from what I understand, listen to a lot of Yiddish recordings. Did he listen to cantorial records as well?
No, never any cantorial music. He listened to he did lip sync for charities around Brooklyn, and he listened to operatic records, including Yiddish records, and he did lip sync and mime to those records. But there was always music playing in his shop. The radio was always on, so I became pretty familiar with all the top 40 records. They danced. My parents were very big ballroom dancers, so that music was around. They got into Latin music for a while, so that music was around, and I learned to dance that way. A lot of it ran off from my parents to me until I was able to start my own little thing. I bumped into folk music when I was about 15, and that made me want to get a guitar, and so at the beginning I played only folk music, the folk music that you play at camp around the fireplace, and it developed from there.
Neil Diamond, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. His new CD, Home Before Dark, is the first album of his career to reach number one on the charts.
No words could say how I love you. No words could be as true. I've looked through books and read through dictionaries, but I've found no words for you. No words. No words.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. Just as there was a swirl of protests surrounding the Florida vote in the 2000 presidential election, protests have surfaced about some of the scenes and portrayals included in HBO's new made-for-TV movie about that election, Recount, which premieres Sunday. Some of the Democrats who fought for Al Gore say they're portrayed as wimps, that certain things in the movie never were said, and that certain scenes depicted just didn't happen. Republicans, by and large, are more pleased by their portrayals in Recount. But they, too, agree that some Democrats come off as ineffectual and that a lot of scenes and lines of dialogue are wholly fictional. Gasp. Really? One thing I find really amusing about the minor controversy surrounding Recount, the HBO movie, not the actual election, is that even in a drama whose point is to show how easily history can be affected and even manipulated, it comes as a shock to some people that Hollywood plays by the same street-fighting rules. Anyone who comes to a fact-based drama, whether on TV or film, expecting to be told the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, simply expects too much. Characters are composited. Scenes are invented. And while I firmly believe that the closer you get to the actual truth, the more interesting things really are, filmmakers rarely work by that same standard. That's why, to me, the most involving and memorable sequences in Recount are ones closest to real life. To demonstrate the chaos of election night, screenwriter Danny Strong lets the TV network anchors do the talking. A montage of actual clips from that very long evening make the point perfectly, including NBC's Tom Brokaw calling Florida for Gore, then putting the state back in the too-close-to-call column. What the networks giveth, Brokaw says sheepishly, the networks taketh away. Later in the movie, when Bush v. Gore reaches the Supreme Court, representatives for the candidates argue their respective cases, and we hear whole chunks from actual court transcripts. These, too, are fascinating. The rest of Recount, though, takes an inarguably compelling story and doesn't do quite enough with it. It comes close and has a fine cast, led by Kevin Spacey as Gore's former chief of staff, Ron Klain. He and Laura Dern, as Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris, are the most fun to watch. And the toughest guy in the fight, according to this account, turns out to be George W. Bush's point man, James Baker III. He's portrayed by Tom Wilkinson, who just played Benjamin Franklin in another HBO fact-based political drama, John Adams. The comparison is not only convenient, it's delicious. Both Franklin and Baker embrace the law, but when Wilkinson as Baker does it, it's to thank his staff for using it to stave off a recount.
People are going to say all kinds of things about this election. That it was down to 154 votes, that Bush's brother was the governor, that the U.S. Supreme Court gave it to us. But I want you to remember that we won every single recount. Never once did we trail Gore. And who knows how many votes we lost when the networks called Florida for Gore before all the polls were closed on election night. But more important than all that is that the system worked. There were no tanks on the streets. This peaceful transfer of power in the most emotional and trying of times is a testament to the strength of the Constitution and to our faith in the rule of law.
Dennis Leary, Bob Balaban, and Ed Begley Jr. are other talented actors with meaty roles here. The candidates themselves are heard but not seen, except in news clips. This is a story about the staffers fighting for their guys. Recount moves quickly and tells a story that's so amazing it doesn't need embellishment. Yet screenwriter Strong does embellish. There's a tacked-on scene at the end, for example, in which James Baker and Ron Klain meet, by coincidence, on the airport tarmac as they're about to board separate private planes. It smells like a scene contrived to get the two main adversaries to share at least one moment together. And that's exactly what it is. Contrived. It never happened. But this is a first-time writing effort for Danny Strong, who's more familiar as a young character actor. He was on Gilmore Girls for a while, as Doyle, and appeared on Buffy the Vampire Slayer as Jonathan, the shortest of the nerds who banded together against her. While Recount is enjoyable, it's not exceptional. It's certainly no Barbarians at the Gate, the HBO movie that remains the gold standard for this particular genre. That one, starring James Garner, was about the attempted takeover of a tobacco company, and was brilliant. Then again, it was written by Larry Gelbart, who isn't exactly a novice screenwriter. Recount throws you right back into that world of undervotes and hanging chads, and will teach you a thing or two, including that the correct plural of Chad is Chad. Just don't accept everything in Recount as gospel and enjoy the ride. If you can agree to that, then I have no problem giving Recount my vote.